things that we want to focus on this afternoon is the 2005 amendments. I can hear you, though. That concludes my remarks. Okay, is that it? What is this? I'm afraid to use this. How's that sound? Okay, very good. We want to talk about the 2005 amendments to the bankruptcy code. As you can see in the first slide, and it's been talked about by a number of people that have already been up here at the dais, obviously the CDS market has exploded. It's much more complex, perhaps, than it, you know, several years ago. Probably more complex than it was a few years ago. So consequently, when you take a look at the 2005 Act changes to the bankruptcy code, which I think were fairly broad sweeping changes relative to these types of financial instruments, it sort of begs to the question as to whether or not those exceptions and how they really fit in the context of a much broader financial instrument, you know, the complexity of the baskets and these synthetics and hybrid instruments. And while the bankruptcy code was designed to really give relief for certain parties with certain contracts, it will be very interesting, I think, as the termination of certain of these contracts, occur, you know, relative to what relief was given to them in the 2005 code changes. So let's just briefly go through those, and then I want to highlight a couple of the provisions, code provisions that were changed, and talk about what we're likely to see in terms of some litigation. First of all, the code gave certain participants in certain contracts code relief, and that code relief came in several areas. It came in the automatic stay area. It came in the ipso facto termination clause area. It came in the area of set-off, rejection damages, as well as in the avoidance area. And we had a slight debate here just before the Douglas Baird and I had a debate just before I got up here to the podium. Only certain types of parties and only certain types of contracts are eligible for these exceptions. You've got to fit within those definitions. Generally under the bankruptcy code, your status of a claim and your rights are determined as of the petition date. So really these code sections that give the relief we'll talk about in a moment are really driven by what the status of the contract and the claimant existed on the petition date. So if you're for example, a swap participant and you've got a swap contract as of the petition date, then you're able to take benefit under certain of these exceptions. As you read through the definitions of what is a swap participant or what is a financial participant, and I'll cite you specifically to Section 101.22A of the code, which is the definition for financial participant. That's just an example of what you should look at here, because it really requires you to be a financial participant at the time you enter into the contract or at the time of the filing of the petition. So query whether or not, you know, it transfers of claims, of these types of claims after the petition date to a party who's not otherwise a party who entered into a contract prior to the petition date and has that status as of the petition date, you know, is able to benefit from certain of these exceptions. It's to me, there's a little bit of a fracture between the language here. And while there's a lot of debate about your ability to step into the shoes of other parties in the code, and that we certainly saw a bit of that in the Enron case, this is a clear example, I think, of where they really intended you to have this status as of the petition date, notwithstanding the broad relief that they wanted to give in this code to these contracts. It seems to suggest that was really for a special class of people. But I'm assuming that that's going to be one of the things that gets litigated. So what are these exceptions? There's the automatic stay exception. It allows the eligible parties to exercise their contractual rights related to eligible contracts, including the right of offset or netting of the termination values, notwithstanding the automatic stay. The ipso facto clause in contracts, that's been amended in 555, 556, 559, and other provisions of the bankruptcy code that allow the eligible parties to cause the liquidation or the termination of a contract, notwithstanding the normal invalidity of those types of clauses. Set-offs are allowed. Rejection damage exceptions are there in 562 of the code, and the avoidance action exceptions, that being in 546C of the code, that prohibits a debtor or a trustee in the case of a trustee in possession of the estate from using its avoidant powers to recover margin payments, settlement payments, and other types of transfers. So these are the exceptions that apply, and they're pretty broad sweeping, although what we're going to find here is that I think there's some ambiguity to these code provisions. Specifically, I want to take you through one of the issues, really under 562. There's a slide here called Determining the Size of the Claim. If we flip to that, if you look at the section 562 of the code that was added, there's a provision that basically says that specifies the damages are measured as of the termination date, or if you're talking about a rejection, it's as of the rejection date. Damages under that code section have to be measured by reference to a commercially reasonable determinants of value as of that date. So it's got to be a commercially reasonable determinant. Now, what is that? I mean, in a very simple context, you're going to go out and you're going to get a quote, if you will, and that's, and provided you do that quickly, and it's a, you know, arm's length quote, that's going to be a value. But there are some situations where you can get into trouble with that. There was a recent case, and I can give the group the site after the session, where the party going out to seek the quote tells the party that they're seeking a replacement contract about certain risks inherent in the ultimate contract. And there's litigation over it, and that litigation is whether or not sharing that risk, this is your backroom office, sharing the risk somehow affected that value. And in that case, the court determined that that value swing was about $46 million. So I think in the execution of some of these quotation practices, there is certainly room for people to have some arguments on what otherwise ought to be a very straightforward quotation. The standard under the code, pursuant to legislative history, is really dictated by state law. There is sections, provisions in the code that talk about an earlier subsequent date if the date of termination measurement does not exist. If you object to it, you've got the burden of proof on that as an objecting party. The other thing that's relevant, of course, is that, for example, if you're using the 2002 ISDA master agreement, ISDA certainly gives guidance as to this. There's a closeout amount as calculated and paid, lists out the closeout components to it. And again, the primary method for determining these differences are going to be the market quotes. I think that by and large, 2002 ISDA is congruent with the changes that were made, for example, in 562, although I do think there are some wording differences that ultimately may be important for parties and ultimately may be the source of some litigation. And I suspect, we had Mr. Pickle here earlier, he'd be a good guy to ask this question to, as there's further enhancements to those master agreements. So they're very, they're excellent documents and they've standardized these transactions largely, but as there's further enhancements to it, and there certainly are worldwide differences, I think, in some of these clauses, but as those changes perhaps differ from what was embedded in that, the bankruptcy code, I think you're going to find further areas where the contract provisions, while defining the rights of the parties, may differ, in fact, from the bankruptcy court relief that was given to those very parties. So as I think it's really important to kind of put all of these exceptions in the context of the contracts that you're dealing with, because ultimately, While good faith and commercial reasonableness can be a matter of differing of opinion, I mean, ultimately the boundaries of that are going to be the contract itself, and that's really something to sort of focus on, regardless of any other issue. I think that one of the areas, if, for example, in this 562, that really clearly to me is going to be an area for litigation. I think you're going to have difficulties, in obtaining market quotations for replacement transactions. I think the fact that the market disruption and the turmoil we have right now in the marketplace, in fact, will contribute to that and lead to higher damages. It's certainly tougher to get quotes. I think there are certainly some impediments, if you will, to pricing transactions that are not mirror transactions. I think there are issues that parties are going to have when, for example, they've got a basket transaction. They're trying to price one strip of that basket, and ultimately a question will be on the counterparty's perspective is there some effect that the rest of that basket may have had on the ultimate pricing that contributed to that particular strip that's being priced for replacement. So I think the more complex instrument will certainly have some issues that relate to valuation and damages in these counterparty situations. I want to spend a few minutes on just really the adequacy of the quotation process. There has been some litigation about it. I think in one of the handouts, there's some examples of some litigation that's occurred to date about this. Bill McSherry mentioned that there's not been a lot of litigation, but there certainly has been some litigation. Again, it will center on how extensive was the effort to get quotes, what was said in the quotation process, how long did it take to get that quote, how many quotes were taken, what ultimately were the process and procedures to get those quotes for replacement value. All of this, I mean, notwithstanding what seemingly is this very clear code section, multiple code sections on the ability of parties to be accepted out from restraints in the bankruptcy code, it's fraught with potential for litigation as sort of procedures break down in terms of valuing either the collateral or ultimately the replacement value of these contracts. One issue that I won't spend a lot of time on, but I just want to note for parties that's still an open issue post Enron. There was a case that was litigated in the Enron bankruptcy called Springfield v. Enron or Enron v. Springfield, and it was a simple bank debt transfer. And the question is to whether or not the party who held the claim post-petition was subject to having their claim equitably subordinated and disallowed, notwithstanding, theoretically, I guess, that transferee was an innocent party. And, in other words, did that equitable subordination flow to that party, notwithstanding their innocence? There was an opinion that was issued by the Federal District Court, Judge Shindlin, and the distinction that was made in that decision, which I'm sure some of you have read and has received a lot of press, was sort of distinction between a sale and assignment. There was exceptions, that were expressed related to holders in due course. Certainly to the extent that someone took on a post-petition basis, obviously with notice of the bankruptcy, it would make them ineligible as a holder in due course. But there's a footnote in that case, in footnote 91 of that opinion, if you want to go back and look at it, and it basically says, wait a minute, this is not a CDS. If this were a CDS, and this was an agreement that was entered into pre-petition, and these transfers were being made pursuant to that pre-petition contract, everything I've just said may be thrown out the window, meaning that perhaps that claim might not be subject to equitable subordination. So that issue, I just want to let you know, is still outstanding, and that opinion, of course, was quite controversial, and I would expect that we'll hear some litigation about that at some point in time as claim holders who acquired these claims are challenged based on the conduct of the assignor or the seller, depending on your view. Bill?
If I might, Professor Baird, could you comment on a question that I have, which is, what impact do credit default swaps have on the actual operations of a typical Chapter 11?
Well, I think the typical plain vanilla Chapter 11 where the counterparty that is not